You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 1st of February 2018 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Tom Edwards. On today's programme, the standoff between the US President Donald Trump and the FBI continues. Trump wants to release a memo that allegedly proves the agency is biased against him. My guests Carol Walker and Michael Binion will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including Poland's controversial bill that makes it illegal to accuse Poles of complicity in the Holocaust, the latest arguments over the conditions under which the UK would leave the EU, and a new version of the world-famous board game Monopoly that actively encourages cheating. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. A warm welcome to Midori House. It's a little cold in our waiting room, I've just discovered, but the warmth here is very much in evidence in the studio, where we find my guests today, political analyst Carol Walker and Michael Binion, foreign affairs specialist for The Times of London. Welcome both to the programme. Good to have you with us. We start today in the United States, where the leading Democrat on the US House Intelligence Committee has accused Republicans of tampering with a memo detailing FBI surveillance at the 2016 election. It allegedly reveals that the FBI abused its surveillance powers to target the Trump campaign. In order to be made public, the secret document would need to be approved by President Trump. And I believe this is sort of being talked about even by the man himself, more or less as we speak. Carol, let me come to you first of all. The Democrats here are claiming that this memo, such as it is, has been materially altered, supposedly, by hands within the GOP. Now, that would be yet another manifestation of the sort of fakery, alternative fact, whatever we want to call it, and rather concerning, presumably.
Yeah, my goodness, what a tangled web and what vicious infighting there is in the upper echelons in Washington. It almost makes the politics here in the UK look quite calm and peaceful by comparison.
We'll come to that later and see if that's
absolutely
the case.
But essentially, this goes to the heart of the allegations as to whether the Russians meddled in the last presidential campaign. As we understand it, this memo is going to set out that the FBI was engaged in overstepping the mark and indeed spying on elements within Donald Trump's own campaign. And it seems that Donald Trump wants this memo out there because he's out to discredit the FBI. He thinks that this whole suggestion that the Russians were involved is merely an attempt to try to undermine his presidency, his campaign, the whole reason that he got elected. He's already fired one boss at the FBI, and it seems he's now not too happy with his successor, even though this successor, Christopher Wray, is somebody who was appointed by Donald Trump himself. So this is some really murky wheeling and dealing, but I think it also further exposes the huge gulf of mistrust and aggression that there is between the presidency and the leading intelligence agency, which is surely pretty worrying for a democracy like the United States.
Well, indeed, and we'll talk a bit more about some of the other manifestations of this in a moment, particularly if there's the Mueller inquiry, which obviously continues. But Michael, just to that point about suggestions, or I guess it's a sort of a hint, really, from the Trump administration, or, you know, some sort of allusion to the idea of the FBI, an inherent bias, maybe even a sort of conspiracy or collusion to discredit him. Surely that kind of claim can't hold water, even if they publish this memo.
Well, it's very difficult to know because it is quite clear the FBI has been drawn into politics in a way that it didn't really want to be. The whole question about releasing that memo over Hillary Clinton's use of emails during the election campaign, in a way, they were damned if they did and damned if they didn't. They did release it, and it did apparently have some discernible effect, and they were accused then of being a patsy for the Republicans, helping the Republicans to damage Hillary. Since then, it's gone the other way. They've been sort of pushed backwards and forwards, with both sides saying that they are hostile to either the Democrats or the Republicans. The FBI itself has clearly got some people in it who are deeply suspicious of President Trump's mode of operations. They think he is dishonest. They think he is not abiding by the proper principles under which federal government is administered. And the fact that he has tried at various times, first of all, to sack the former director, and then to try to say to other senior officials, I would lay off that inquiry if I were you. In other words, try to interfere in their work. Now, that leads to a poisonous atmosphere between the two, which, as Carol says, is what we're left with now.
And, Carol, to that point then about the inquiry, the Mueller inquiry, ultimately, that's what we're looking at. Is this about an attempt by Trump and his inner circle to undermine that inquiry, either explicitly, as Michael suggests there, by directly critiquing or criticising people or trying to remove them from their posts, or just by spreading this general view, a scepticism about the impartiality of the people who are actually conducting the investigation?
Well, I think, as Michael says, not only have the intelligence agencies been dragged into the political battleground, but those who are trying to investigate what went on have also become, to an extent, political footballs. We know that President Trump wants to try to spike the guns of Robert Mueller, who is carrying out one of a number of different investigations into what the Russian involvement was. We know that, for example, senior figures in the Trump campaign did meet senior Russian figures. So far, nothing has been proved to show that the Russians did have undue influence. But clearly, these are important matters. Robert Mueller seems to be, so far, doggedly trying to get to the truth. But at every step of the way, it is clear that Donald Trump and senior figures around him are out to try to weaken that inquiry, to undermine it, and to discredit those, accusing them of fake news, anyone who suggests that his campaign was influenced by the Russians.
Michael, I've asked you before about the impact of the Trump White House on the perspectives of the global community on the US, and whether he could be doing even irreparable damage in terms of foreign policy and how the US is perceived overseas. If we look at the domestic picture, is there a similar element? We seem to see now that the discourse, if you like, in DC is, you know, you accuse me of collusion, I accuse you of collusion. You cite evidence and sources, I find these sources myself and I publish them. Are we going to damage the domestic political discourse because of a polarised politics, sure, with the GOP and the Democrats ever further apart, but also with this constant sort of slinging of mud from one side to the other?
Well, I think what it will do is to bring the entire political process into further discredit. It's already pretty discredited in many Americans' eyes. They feel that Congress is both institutionally incapable of taking a responsible line in as a partner in government. They see a complete dysfunction between Congress and the presidency. Even in former times, when you had a president of one party and a Congress of the other, they usually worked out a way of working together to get legislation through. Now it looks like permanent and total gridlock, which angers a number of Americans. I have to say, there are a lot of Americans who simply don't care. They sort of look, what they care about is how's the economy doing? And it's doing pretty well. And that makes a big, big difference. And this tax cut, which a lot of people opposed on principle, saying it rewards the rich and it doesn't actually help the poor and the struggling, to many Americans, it's a bonanza. And it's also brought up the stock exchange. It's really lifted spirits. So for them, that's all that matters. And the general discredit that Congress seems to have brought upon itself and that Trump has brought on them, and the partisan wrangling here and there, for many people, it just says, they're all the same. We don't care.
Well, I mean, that's quite an alarming picture, Carol. Do you go along with that? And I suppose my follow-up would be, if there is that sort of institutional incapability to be either a counterpoint or to help drive any sort of agenda forwards, is the risk there, particularly as Michael says, that the economy is doing well, that sense of ennui from enough people reaches sort of critical mass and we're just locked into, you know, more of the same, certainly beyond the midterms, but maybe even beyond 2020?
Well, part of Trump's success, part of the reason why he won the election and became president is that he was seen as an anti-establishment figure. He was seen as somebody who would take on the elite, that he would stand on the sides of the early of the ordinary working people. And he promised to bring jobs and to boost the economy, which, as Michael has pointed out, he has been pretty successful at. I think that what still does trouble many Americans, as well as many outside the United States, is that even though in that State of the Union address he talked a lot about unity and about bringing the country together, that was combined with further restricting the rights of migrants, that was combined with standing by his pledge to build a wall with Mexico, to overturning President Obama's pledge to close down Guantanamo Bay. In many ways, the realities and the practical policies did not match the rhetoric. And I think that many people do still see President Trump as a hugely divisive figure and are very concerned about what that legacy is going to mean in the United States.
Let's continue to Poland now, where the Senate has approved a controversial bill that makes it illegal to accuse Poles of complicity in the Holocaust. The bill also prohibits describing Nazi death camps in Poland as Polish death camps. People who break the new law could be jailed. The move's angered Israel, which accuses Poland of attempting to rewrite history. Michael Binion, defenders of this piece of legislation have said it's about the defence of a nation's historical truths. And I wonder where that defence can end and, let's be frank, Holocaust denial can begin. Does this sit uneasily with you?
I think it sits very uneasily. I think it's absurd to legislate on what is true history and what is false history. To say that no single Pole in any way at any time was ever involved in doing anything to help Jews, or at least to help Nazis kill Jews, is clearly absurd, even if they did it under duress, without knowing. To make a blanket law saying, if you say something like that, you go to prison, is absurd. Trying to say, to tell the world, we were not the guilty party, we were occupied, we were restricted, we were ourselves suffering, perfectly reasonable to try to make sure that the world understands that they were not Polish death camps. On the other hand, I have to say, most of this is because the present government has a pretty nationalist agenda, which is intent on bolstering Polish pride in Polish history. Fine, but it can go a little bit too far into some really gung-ho nationalism.
Well, and Carol, to that point, this seems from without a clear sort of sop to the right wing, to these nationalist elements. We've documented their rise, their unfortunate rise in Poland before. I always find it confusing that the government in power can't itself recognise that that's how such a move will be seen from without. And this is the kind of thing I would have thought. You would be more concerned about the global reaction than the domestic reaction. But is that wrong? Is the point that, again, they're playing to a populist agenda, it sits well with aspects of their domestic constituency, and frankly, they don't care how angry the criticism is from Israeli PMs or from anyone else?
Well, look, it does seem to be a ludicrously over-the-top and repressive move to make to essentially restrict free speech. Let's not forget that Poland did go through a very difficult, painful period under Nazi occupation. And of course, as Michael pointed out, there was a very strong resistance. There will also have been people who, in some way or another, may have somehow, for the sake of saving their families, complied with some of what the Nazis were asking. To turn around and say, look, we can't even discuss this, seems to be a ridiculous attempt to try to stifle debate on this very difficult and painful period in Poland's history. The government justifies this by saying, well, people are just talking rather sloppily about Polish death camps and Polish concentration camps. These were camps that were run by the Nazis, not by Poles. It was Poles who were victims of that. But surely in this day and age, any European government should be able to counter some of those that sloppy shorthand and to underline the point that Poles were victims in all of this without resorting to such repressive tactics as it is doing here. Israel and the United States have objected, and I have to say, on this issue, I would agree with both of them.
Well, and Michael, to go back on that, the supreme irony to me here is that the amendment is made ostensibly to sort of correct, you know, semantic errors and to sort of put the record straight against the facts is the language used. But if history has told us anything since the atrocities of the Holocaust, is that it is exactly that. It's that the language absolutely matters, the details matter, the culpability, the admissions, the reflection matters. And so under the guise of trying to address a semantic sort of mistake, they're proving the opposite in a way.
I think what they're thinking is that it's our turn to use language and law in the same way that Germany has done in putting through a law making it a criminal offence to deny the Holocaust. But they're completely unequal in their both import and in what they entail. Denying the Holocaust is denying the greatest human atrocity Europe has known. To say that no Poles ever took part is a sort of footnote to that. And to sort of say we have the right to put forward the same sort of legislation that Germany has put forward, or one or two, I think Austria as well, it's completely non-comparable. I think that the attempt to do this is misguided. It will backfire. And I do agree with Carol that both Israel and the United States have very valid objections.
And Carol, it's interesting to me. We talked a lot over the last sort of 12 to 18 months about the welcome failure of certain populist movements to gain political traction across Europe. Actually, there were a number of elections where there were potential flashpoints, even in France or in the Netherlands and so on. When you see things like this, does this remind us that, far from being complacent, we need to watch out for a very continual and insidious, almost, creeping of a decidedly unpleasant. It's clearly pandering to a quite aggressive nationalist agenda. And if we allow elements either in government, who are in government because they need the assistance of the right wing, or who are in the centre leaning towards the right, if they continue to sort of engage in this kind of behaviour, this kind of rhetoric, it is still a very, very sort of dicey path that we're walking.
Well, I think what is clear is that although some of those right-wing populist parties didn't do quite as well as some people had feared, they have nonetheless got significant footholds in Germany, significant footholds in France and in Austria, and in Poland you have got this right-wing nationalist government, which, as Michael is pointing out, is appealing to sections of Polish society by trying to instill this sense of nationalistic pride. I would hope that many of those citizens would then look at this measure and think, well, this is a ridiculously repressive move. This restricts free speech. We Poles are now part of the European Union. We want to be an outward-looking democracy, and this is not the way to go. But I think what is clear is that none of those right-wing parties actually succeeded in seizing power, but they are nonetheless in much stronger positions in many of those countries than they were before, and they remain a strong force to be reckoned with.
Not least in Hungary, where they've also taken on overtly anti-Semitic overtones with the campaign against George Soros, who himself is Jewish and who has supported democratic development in Hungary. And that is probably an even more worrying situation than we see in Poland.
Well, just briefly then, what's the best response, whether it's sort of from the, you know, the EU bloc or from the US or from wherever? Does there need to be some sort of sanction offered against
that
Poland?
Well,
it seems rather heavy-handed.
Heavy-handed. It doesn't work. They tried sanctions once against Austria, well, kind of political sanctions, when Austria let in the Freedom Party, which is a fairly right-wing and is now in the junior partner in the coalition. And that simply backfired, and the Austrians were absolutely furious. And similarly, the Poles are making much of this attempt to block EU kind of help to Poland on these grounds. No, you can speak out, but trying political sanctions, if the government in question can turn it around saying, look, they're all against us, it only makes them stronger. So I think engagement and quiet persuasion and as much dialogue as possible is the best way.
Indeed. The thoughts of Michael Binion and Carol Walker alongside me, Tom Edwards, here on Midori House. Up next, the latest turns and twists in the Brexit saga.
From the rise of pet furniture to a raft of new museums and a fresh breed of political provocateurs, there are plenty of reasons to look forward to 2018. Luckily, we've packed lots of them into more than 200 pages of the new edition of the Monocle Forecast. It's the magazine for those who want to look beyond the horizon and spot the new opportunities the new year will bring. We'll look at the political conversations you'll be having, the startups to invest in, and the cities you'll want to call home. The Forecast is packed with opinion and wit, with ideas and provocations, and guaranteed to keep you talking all the way through 2018.
Welcome back to Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. Carol Walker and Michael Binion still here. Let's stay in the UK now. Prime Minister Theresa May has made clear her absolute opposition to the EU insistence that the free movement of people continue during any transitional period after the UK leaves the bloc, if indeed it does, as planned in March of next year. In other news, George Osborne, the former Chancellor, of course, has warned May that she doesn't have, or retain perhaps, enough power to push through a hard Brexit. This comes after a leaked analysis ordered by the government suggests the UK economy would be significantly worse off in every single different modelled Brexit scenario. Michael, let's sort of look at this from May's perspective. She's, of course, busy in China at the moment, suggesting that we're open for business as usual. There's no way that the EU or any of the other 27 will accept any sort of block on free movement, presumably, if any vestige of the membership rights are to endure for Britain during a transitional period. They've been pretty clear about that. Why pick a fight on that?
Well, May is floundering. She's being pushed here and there. She's trying to find a sort of compromise middle way. But on many of these things, there is no compromise middle way. And to some extent, the Brexiteers are becoming somewhat panicky that they're not getting the key, clean, sudden, clear exit they thought was on the way. They rather think that May herself is beginning to listen to the rather insistent warnings by the Chancellor of the Exchequer, Philip Hammond, that business would be severely damaged if we go for a sudden, clear break with everything. So she's moving sort of backwards and forwards here and there, trying to appease both one side and then the other side with little gestures here, little gestures there, and ending up with nothing. I mean, you end up losing everything. And sadly, because there's no clear direction one way or the other, everybody ends up hating you. And I'm afraid poor May is now not only beleaguered within her own party and within her own government, subject to endless backbiting, speculation and gossip about her own authority, but also pretty well paralysed from exercising any authority of any kind in any area of government.
Well, and indeed, Carol, she's offering these sort of almost proxy negotiating pushes by speaking to the press and saying, well, of course, this would be an indisputable insistence that we would have in Britain. But you get the same cutting back the other way. Guy Verhofstadt went on the record and said, well, this is simply not up for negotiation, and that's that. And as Michael says, this sort of proxy negotiation through the press, that is not going to go anywhere other than increasingly poorly for May.
This is a desperate attempt by Theresa May to prove that to the Brexiteers that she really, really can stand up for Britain's rights in these negotiations. This comes down to this transition period, which would start after Britain leaves in March 2019. Theresa May has said up to now is that, well, we'd stick with many of the same rules and arrangements. We still have access to the free market during that two-year transition period. And the EU27, the other European countries, have said, well, yeah, that's fine, but if you're going to do that, then we've got to have freedom of movement. Theresa May has come back and said, oh, no, that's not going to happen. But this is pure semantics. The government has already made it clear that after Brexit, EU citizens will still have the right to come and live and work here. They will simply have to register to get settled status. We are talking about a bureaucratic hurdle. Theresa May is trying desperately to prove to these Brexiteers that she has got a bit of guts. But I fear this is going to fail. What has changed in recent weeks, and Michael referred to this, is that those people who want Britain to make a really clear break with the European Union are worried that she's backsliding and are worried that she has realised that the arithmetic in the Houses of Parliament means that if she did go for what's called a hard Brexit, a really clear break, she probably wouldn't get it through Parliament. A deal on those terms could well be voted down. So the signals are that she's moving towards a much softer Brexit, and that could remove the protection that she's had from up until now by some of those ardent Brexiteers.
I would make one other point, and that is it's particularly on this question of immigration or movement into this country that Theresa May seems to have a sort of blind spot. Even at the Home Office, her absolute overriding obsession was to stop people coming as immigrants to Britain. And that's the one thing that she got about the referendum, the message, we don't want more people coming in. Actually, there were different messages. We don't want people from the EU. Well, that was half a message. It was really, we don't want people from outside the EU. But she herself has been extremely hardline on this and always has been. And she thinks that that's what people want. And therefore, she's quite happy to pick a fight on this particular question.
And she is right in that immigration was a very significant factor in that Brexit vote. Many of those people who voted to leave the European Union did so because of the perception that there is too much immigration and that by leaving the European Union, Britain could get back control. That was the slogan used by those who campaigned to leave. She knows it is an important issue, and I think that's why she's choosing to at least attempt to make a stand. The danger is, of course, she's got to stick to her guns. She can't afford to back down now, otherwise all those weak and wobbly accusations will come flooding back, and she is already in a very, very precarious situation.
And a situation, just briefly on this, not aided by George Osborne, of course, former Chancellor, who she sort of unceremoniously helped to get rid of. Shouldn't he...
Sacked him, basically, I think is what you're trying to say, Tom.
But just, Mike, on that point, he, in a sense, played his own role in getting us into this mess. He was part of the Cameron strategy team, presumably, who decided it was a good idea to include an in-out pledge in the referendum, whether it was going to be a bargaining chip to go or whatever. Shouldn't he pipe down? I don't want to restrict the free press.
Well, but he is a journalist, and I have to say he's piping up quite well. Most of the papers on the right in Britain are total Brexiteer papers. They're there pushing harder and harder and harder. His paper, The Evening Standard, is one of the few that's really saying this is madness. And he's saying it loud and strong. And he's also voicing a lot of the discontent. I think he has every right to do so. Yes, I agree. He bears quite a lot of responsibility and also some of the responsibility for a scare campaign in the referendum. If you leave, the sky will fall down. You will all be ruined, which hasn't immediately happened. So to that extent, he can be blamed. But now, more power to him. I think he's saying some useful stuff.
Words I never thought I'd hear uttered on Midori House. More power to George Osborne. Just finally, before the end of the programme, Monopoly is releasing a special edition of its famous game, sold specifically for cheats. Hasbro, the company behind it, says it's learned so many players cheat anyway, it's decided to create a new version that actually encourages and rewards the breaking of the rules. And this Cheaters Edition, Carol, will be out in August. I was going to ask you, who would you buy this game for? But I guess the more interesting question would be, who would you not want to play at this game, perhaps, if it rewards the most arch amongst us?
I wouldn't want to play anybody at this game because I hate Monopoly. I think Monopoly is the devil's game even before this new edition was introduced. I think Monopoly is incredibly tedious, boring. It goes on and on and on. And this is clearly a desperate attempt to try to convince us that there's something new and fresh about it and we should give it a go. And so when we sit down with our kids, look, I don't want to start trying to climb onto the moral high ground on this, but if I'm then going to sit down and say, well, yeah, but you can win if you cheat, if you nick my money, or try and pretend that you're renting this out legitimately when actually it's you're getting round the rules, it's not going to convince me. I think Monopoly is an appalling game. But go for Articulate instead. It's much more fun, much noisier, and much quicker.
I'm just hearing that Hasbro has formally cancelled Carol Walker's Christmas card this year.
I think it's quite amusing because there are all sorts of ingenious ways you can make Monopoly up to date. For example, you can buy houses and sneakily turn them into hotels by renting out them on Airbnb all the time.
Yeah,
and
that's very good.
Do all kinds of other things that are pretty much a 21st century phenomenon. And of course, I mean, it depends how you cheat. You can embezzle all your money from the bank. I mean, what you can do is you can simply replicate today's life on the board. Those rather kind of prim deals that were done in the 1920s and 30s don't exist anymore, and nor does speculation on land and all that sort of thing. So make it a today game. And as for cheating, well, that's a long history in board games. There was a game called Diplomacy where you were meant to cheat as part of the rules.
Well, and this is the idea here. And what about this point about an opponent you wouldn't want to face on the other side of a game that rewards, as I said, the arch and most devious?
Well, I wouldn't want to take
Someone
on
from,
any
from
estate
the
agent.
Village.
I wouldn't want to take on any person who's sort of 20 and consulting the internet secretly to get the, you know, cheating that way, getting outside help to do something they shouldn't do.
OK, very, very good stuff. Well,
you wouldn't want to take on Donald Trump because, well, you'd suspect his, he'd probably... Oh, no, I won't say anymore.
He's been playing that game.
Anymore.
He's played the updated anymore. Game right from the start.
I think this is how he actually makes his real-life decisions, perhaps. That's a sobering thought on which to close. Thank you both very much. Kara Walker and Michael Binion, thanks for being our guests on Midori House today. The programme was produced by Mark Sippy, research by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and James Kitchen, and our studio manager was Christy Evans. My thanks to them all. Music for you next. Andrew Tuck is here with The Urbanist at the top of the next hour, and we'll have more on all the big stories of the day and any developments viz Trump and his memo on the Monocle Daily at 2200 London time. This show's back at the same time tomorrow, 1800 here in London. I'm Tom Edwards. Thank you for listening.